This is the MDT podcast.
A podcast for all healthcare professionals working with older adults. We are a multidisciplinary team educating about aging, MDT.
The MDT is brought to you by the Hearing Aid podcast team. We focus on a different topic each week to work with you to enhance your knowledge to help you look after older people.
Welcome to this episode of the MDT. I'm Dr. Ian Wilkinson. I'm a consultant geriatrician down in Surrey. And this is the second episode of the seventh series of the MDT. But I am, well, I'm not alone today, but I'm almost alone today because Joe, our partner in crime, is not here today. Sometimes, you know, life happens and work happens and stuff, and it's just not possible to be everywhere at once. So Joe's not here. As ever, we don't make these episodes in isolation, so we've had some help from the faculty. Two of the faculty for today's episodes are in the studio with me today, and you'll hear from them in a moment. But also Susan Hendrickson and Pamela Trangmar have helped us in making this episode.
Hi, I'm Catherine Mainwaring. I'm a geriatrics registrar in South East London, and I have interests in medical education and perioperative care, and in particular silver trauma. So 2 years ago on my UP, I set up a silver trauma course, which is a one-day simulation course for all members of the MDT, which can I shamelessly plug now, Ian?
Yes.
Is still running in two London hospitals, and we've got dates coming up this coming year. So if you're interested, then I'll make sure Ian's got the links, but look for the Silver Trauma course at Guy's and St Thomas's or King's College London.
And you presented that at ASME as well, haven't you?
All over ASME, BGS, but yeah, very much influenced by the work of Dave Raven, who we'll hear about later on today.
Hello, I am Rebecca Norton. I'm a fifth year medical student at the University of Glasgow.
Nice to have you here, Rebecca. Now, can you tell us how you got involved with this?
I actually got involved in this slightly by accident. I really wanted the MDT podcast to cover geriatric trauma, so I emailed with that as a suggestion, and was promptly invited to actually help make the podcast. And I felt like I couldn't really back out, so here I am.
Good. And it's really nice to have you. So this episode is on trauma in older people, or silver trauma. And coming up this week, we're going to talk about the frequency and severity of trauma in older people, trying to understand a little bit about why older people are at risk of traumatic events and sort of traumatic happenings, how to assess the severity of an injury in an older person, and to understand a little bit about why the mechanism of injury for major trauma may require less sort of force in older people than younger people. But first, before we do that, we're going to kick off in the usual way by talking about something from social media or the news this week. Rebecca, do you want to go first? What have you got?
Yes. So something caught my eye on Twitter this week from at Dr. Terry Quinn. He is a senior clinical lecturer from the Institute of Cardiovascular and Medical Sciences at University of Glasgow. It's a review article published in the BMJ on 31st of January. It's called Acute Care Assessment of Older Adults Living with Frailty. I chose this because in it there's a simple graphic to guide initial assessment of the frail older person when they present to acute care settings, and to give a flavour of what is highlighted under four key domains you would find under history, for example, medications, for physical exam, vision and hearing assessment, for psychiatric exam, a delirium screen, and for functional assessment, gait and balance. And what I liked about this is that around these four domains, the authors have highlighted knowledge about the home environment and knowledge of caregivers as that essential contextual information that should shape management of these individuals. So that was what struck me the most, really.
Fab. So we'll tweet the link to that. Catherine?
Seeing as we're talking about trauma this week, a piece that caught my eye following Prince Philip's road traffic collision was David Oliver's opinion piece in the BMJ, When Is It Time for Older Drivers to Stop? So I think it's a really nice measured response to the outrage that there's been in the media. You know, should he still be driving at 96? And actually, I think it's probably something to be celebrated. But there's lots of lovely resources and links in this article. It's something that's not particularly very well taught as part of the medical curriculum, medical conditions and driving. So I'd really advise a quick read, have a little look at the resources and just have a think about how it applies to your day-to-day work.
There was a fab session at the last BGS meeting as well about a company that would do the driving assessments in a sort of a properly objective way. That was really good, I thought. That talk was really good, actually.
It was, I looked to see if the link was on the BGS website, and unfortunately it's not there.
But... I think I got one of the flyers in my clinic, so I'll put the link in on the show notes. Yeah. So my one is from Matteo Cesari, and it's a tweet about an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Internal Medicine Journal. And basically it says, the functional decline or lack of improvement is common in older people with severe frailty undergoing a TAVI, which is an aortic valve replacement that doesn't require sort of an endovascular one. And essentially shows that frailty was a marker of a lack of improvement after the surgery. But what the second sentence struck me more, actually, was that the anticipation of health trajectories is needed to correctly design patient-tailored interventions. And I think that's something that we sometimes don't think about, is actually not where someone is here and now, but actually what's the trajectory that's been happening over the last sort of few months, few years, something like that. And maybe that's a almost like percentage change in degree of frailty rather than an absolute figure, I think is you know, something to think about. And finally, we've got one from Dan. So this is Dan from up north.
So my social media highlight this week is from the pre-social media era. And it's a paper called The Medical Management of Frailty, Confessions of Agnostic. And it's written by Ken Rockwood of the Clinical Frailty Index fame. It was written in 1997, but it was being shared recently on Twitter by Sean Neenan. And it's a great overview of how to look after older people living with frailty. I really like this passage where he writes, our interest in frail patients derived both from the magnitude of the need and from the fact that we have the special skills to meet the challenges they present. And after reading this paper, it's got me on to trying to locate other classic articles that are written sometimes decades ago, but still very relevant for medicine for older people today.
Well, so this week we're going to talk about silver trauma. We should think about a definition of that. And what we're talking about is major trauma in older people. A major trauma is defined using an injury severity score, which kind of assigns a value to injuries of different parts of the body and totals them up to give a figure representing the severity of trauma. And what we're talking about is an injury severity score, an ISS score of more than 15. That's what we call major trauma.
I think the thing that's probably important to say about that is it's not something that can be calculated at the front door. It's a score that can only be put together retrospectively once you know all the injuries that a patient's got. So it's useful in the literature, but in terms of what that practically means for us as physicians, it's not particularly very useful. So another definition that people might find more useful is that it's multiple serious injuries that could result in disability or death. And there's no mention in there about how those injuries might occur.
And the Silver Book, the British Geriatric Society guidelines for the emergency care of the older person, recognises the need for additional special considerations to be integrated with the ATLS approach in a managing elderly trauma, and endorses the view that geriatricians should receive training in the structured assessment of older people trauma, and that would include hip fractures, head injury and polytrauma.
Yeah, I think that's really true. So ATLS is Advanced Trauma Life Support, which is kind of the ABCDE approach to trauma and polytrauma. And you're right, you know, if you're an emergency physician, it's a core part of your training. If you're a surgeon or an anaesthetist, if you're a geriatrician, you may well go through your entire career and not touch on it at all, really. And I think it's important to think about that trauma could mean neurological injury, it could mean chest injury, could mean skeletal injury or internal organ injuries. It's not just broken bones, and it's not just something that orthopaedics look after. Actually, this is something that presents to a range of different specialties within the hospital. And we're actually not going to talk too much in this episode about specifics. You know, we're not going to talk about femoral fractures or neck injuries or one little bit about trauma for too long. We're going to talk about the process and the sort of the overarching themes, really. But I think first we should put this in some historical context, because the nature of trauma is changing, isn't it?
Yeah, so you might be sat there sort of thinking, why have we got a bunch of geriatricians and sort of sat around a table talking about trauma? And that's because trauma is changing in the UK. Traditionally, if I asked you to think about trauma, you'd probably think about a road traffic collision, somebody falling off a building, crush injuries, all the quite high energy impact mechanisms of injury. And this commonly used to affect the younger age group, and commonly it was males. But the trauma population is changing. And that goes partly in line with the fact that we've got an ageing population. But actually, the increase in the size of the older trauma group is out of proportion to the change that's expected for the ageing population. And that may be in part to do with increasing awareness of trauma in older people and the increasing use of CT scans, but it's a growing and it's an important group. So between 1990 and 2013, the average age of major trauma patients has changed from 36 years to 54 years. And the mechanism of injury has also changed. So it used to be that the most common mechanism of injury was a road traffic collision. But now the most common mechanism of injury is a fall from standing height.
So much lower forces involved.
Yeah.
But still producing, you know, potentially devastating injuries. And this led on to the TARN network being set up.
Yeah, so TARN is the Trauma Audit and Research Network. And in the late 1980s, data collated by this network showed that there was unnecessary mortality and that this was caused by inadequacies in the organisation and delivery of care. So what kind of came out of this initial bit of data was development of TARN into a national organisation collecting data on trauma across the whole of the UK. And the type of information collected is would include the type of injury, certain physiological parameters, predicted survival, and compare those with actual outcomes. And that is now the largest trauma database in Europe. So it is a really good source of lots of useful information and research on this very important topic in the UK.
And they produce annual reports. And we'll put a link to the most recent report in the show notes. And just on a note, actually, you can find all of the show notes on the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk. And there's loads of extra stuff on the website that you can access. So trauma systems in the UK are organised geographically into what we call trauma networks. Each network will consist of a major trauma unit. So in the southeast, we've got King's College Hospital in Camberwell in southeast London. We've got St George's Hospital in Tooting in southwest London. And we've got Brighton down on the south coast. Each of those centralises expertise and has all of the main, predominantly surgical specialties involved with trauma. So you've got neurosurgeons, you've got trauma surgeons, cardiothoracic surgeons, vascular people, all of those in the same place. And then you have a variety of peripheral trauma units. So, for example, in my neck of the woods, you've got our unit at East Surrey, you've got the hospital in Guildford, you've got the hospital in Camberley at Frimley Park. And each of those provide care for the majority of patients with injuries. People with more severe injuries will go to the major trauma units. Everyone else will be seen in the other hospitals, which are called trauma units. A similar process is being set up in Scotland with the development of four major centres. Sometimes patients will be seen pre-hospitally, and in that pre-hospital setting, the paramedics and people will use triage tools, think about the transfer time and their clinical judgments to decide whether or not someone's going to a trauma unit or a major trauma unit. The major benefits of the pre-hospital care are actually realised in the second phase of trauma. So the initial phase is that first impact and the first few moments after that, and then the timely provision of care in that time can limit or halt the potentially devastating cascade of events that can otherwise quickly happen. So, for example, thinking about maintaining airways and stuff pre-hospitally is absolutely key. Without pre-hospital care, many people who might otherwise survive their injuries might die at the scene or en route to a hospital. Most deaths from trauma occur in the first hours after the injury and are due to airway compromise, respiratory failure, or uncontrolled hemorrhage. All three of these conditions can be readily treated using basic first aid measures at the scene. All of that comes from a World Health Organization document, actually, about pre-hospital trauma care systems, with a drive to set up pre-hospital care across the world.
I think the thing that we need to mention is sometimes, especially with older patients, the decision as to where to take these patients, be it either to the major trauma centre or to the local trauma unit can be quite challenging, and there's sort of lots of issues around this. So in general, ambulance crews will use something called a trauma triage tool to help them make a decision as to where to take the patient. And that takes into account things such as the vital signs, anatomy of injury, and also the mechanism of injury in order to help them make that decision. Most tools do have some special considerations. So, for example, pregnant women, the morbidly obese and older patients, where the crew can make a judgment decision as to whether that patient should go to a major trauma centre or not. And the idea is to get the right patient to the right place at the right time. But we know that there's issues with these trauma tools when it comes to older patients. And they're just not very good, unfortunately, at identifying older major trauma. So just 17% of major trauma patients older than 60 years old were triaged directly to MTCs by pre-hospital services, compared to 40% of those in the under 60 year old.
And do you think some of that is because traditionally a lot of the focus that we've put on trauma services has focused on the mechanism of the injury, and younger people tend to have those injuries caused by higher forces, whereas with older people maybe you don't think about, or people aren't thinking about trauma as much because the mechanism of injury is much less?
Mechanism of injury certainly plays a part. It's easy to connect the dots when somebody's had a road traffic collision at 40 miles an hour that they might have sustained multiple severe injuries versus somebody who's had a fall from standing. And the issue with falls is it's quite difficult to determine who's had an injurious fall versus a non-injurious fall. The other issue is that some of the physiological parameters that these triage tools use don't take into consideration the anatomy and physiology of older people. So the thresholds that we need to be using for older trauma patients are actually different. So thinking about using a blood pressure of less than 110 millimetres of mercury systolic as a warning sign. We also know that head-injured older patients will have a higher GCS compared to younger patients. So they mask their injuries a lot more.
And this lack of early identification using existing triage tools means that initial treatment is more likely to be in a lower level trauma unit for the older person. It's more likely to be in a district general hospital. It's more likely to be undertaken by a more junior doctor. And it also means that older patients are less likely to be transferred to specialist care. And the result of that is having a longer waiting time to receive key investigations, key interventions. And the TARN network has shown the elderly wait time is longer for a CT head following head injury, for example, and it's there are longer times to surgery across all body areas and across all categories. So it's a very wide-ranging effect.
Is it right to mention in there about sort of what happens if you do go to a major trauma centre and they activate the trauma team? Because I think that's something that probably we don't understand in medicine. So if a trauma call is activated, you get a team of relatively senior doctors, so anaesthetics, trauma team leader, surgeons, who will all turn up to horizontally assess and manage that patient, and you get rapid senior clinical decision making. But what Rebecca was saying there about sort of our younger junior doctors assessing these patients, it's often in a vertical manner. They're doing it on their own. They're doing very good assessments, but that's perhaps why there is that delay, because there's not that team approach to assessing and managing these patients if they're not trauma called.
And I know units are starting to think about this, aren't they? Because, for example, our emergency department have set up this sort of in-house trauma call, if you like, where they older people, you know, may go through that process where you still have the senior decision-making, but maybe not call every single specialty as the initial thing. And people are starting to adapt that sort of ATLS approach. It all sounds very good, but whether or not there's any evidence behind its effectiveness, I guess, is different.
You know? I don't think the evidence is there yet, and it's striking the right balance as well between sort of overburdening these trauma services and doing the right thing for the right patient at the right time.
Actually, we've got an episode on this coming up later this series, prompted by a request from David Oliver about sort of age-appropriate services versus age-discriminatory services. And actually, you know, we want to do the best thing for older people, but by doing that, are we creating a second process, either a better process or a less good process by doing that.
So what does all this mean for survival of elderly people who suffer major trauma or major traumatic injury? As you might expect, age has a profound impact on survival from major trauma. The 12-month mortality in the over 75s is 40%, and you can compare that to only 10% in the over 60s. Although older patients are more likely to die, those who do survive do not have a larger incidence of disability compared to younger people, which is perhaps something you wouldn't expect. And that comes from a piece of research on major trauma in the elderly by Coisier, Kings et al. And that was a very recent piece of research done in 2019, published in Trauma.
So I think what we should do is go through the Advanced Trauma Life Support System of thinking about trauma in an ABCDE approach fairly swiftly, but to think about what this means specifically for older people. And all of this next little bit of content comes from the excellent Jerry EM course and some of their online resources. And I'll put a link to their resources in the show notes, but it's jerry-em.com is where you should head to look for that. So we're going to go A for airway. Do you want to take that, Catherine?
I can take that. So really this is thinking about special considerations for elderly patients. So it may be that arthritis may cause difficulty with mouth opening. So you should always anticipate a difficult airway in an older person. In particular, thinking about their C-spine, they're at increased risk of C-spine injuries, arthritis and spondyloarthritis in the spine can increase their risk of injury there. And trying to immobilise someone's neck when they've got an altered neck posture can be quite challenging. So sort of being pragmatic about C-spine immobilisation. It used to be that the guidance from ATLS was that you, if you had a trauma patient, you would immobilise them, so block tapes and spinal board until you could rule out a C-spine injury. But actually, for a lot of our patients who have altered neck posture who might be delirious or confused, trying to reduce their neck into a neutral position might do more harm than good. And prolonged immobilisation with a collar can have sort of various unintended side effects, such as raised intracranial pressure and pressure sores. So it's actually about trying to move away from that automatic response of having to immobilise someone and thinking about, is this person keeping their head still? Can we just support them with some rolled up towels and some tape, or somebody just holding their head and reassuring them until we can clear their C-spine, rather than having that automatic sort of approach to keeping them still?
So then we're going to move on to B for breathing.
Under B for breathing, the various effects may be caused by the physiology of ageing, but also of the effects of comorbid disease. And the things to think about would be decreased respiratory reserve, having an altered or decreased chest wall musculature. Bone health is a really important issue for the older population, and having more fragile bones, older people's ribs are more easily broken. And decreased chest wall compliance can cause more severe pulmonary contusion. So all of these things could add to your problems with breathing.
Okay, and then C for circulation. So we get age-related changes in your affecting your cardiac output. So your maximum heart rate decreases because it's typically sort of about 220 beats per minute minus your age. You get a decreased response to adrenergic catecholamines because of your reduced responsiveness of your membrane receptors. You get a degree of diastolic dysfunction, and then cardiac output is much more dependent on your atrial filling. You may also have medications such as beta blockers, which further reduce your maximum heart rate, or diuretics that produce a chronically contracted vascular volume, all of which means that there's a common pitfall in assessing circulation in older people to think that normal vital signs are representing normovolemia, which is not always true. So D, for disability.
We've already mentioned earlier on that as you get older, the brain shrinks and there's increased CSF around the brain. So actually it's somewhat protected from cerebral contusions. But what this does mean is that they are at increased risk of intracerebral bleeds, especially with acceleration, deceleration injuries, and that bleed may accumulate for longer than in a younger person before it declares itself. So they don't tend to drop their GCS as quickly.
So this is where your brain has shrunk. And so the vessels that line the inside of the skull vault are kind of stretched across to where the brain is.
Yeah.
And so a bit like wires holding something in place. So as the brain moves, those vessels get stretched and they can rupture further.
And then again, sort of this theme of bone health. So with osteoporosis and osteoarthritic changes, forces that are transferred through the spinal column are more likely to result in spinal fractures. And they may also have less room in the spinal column to accommodate shifts, which can more easily result in spinal cord damage and neurological sequelae.
And then the final bit is E for exposure or environment.
Yeah, so age-related changes affecting injuries relating to E, you need to think about older skin and connective tissue having lost cells and therefore strength and function. So the skin's thinner, it's less vascular, older people are less able thus to thermoregulate, they're more prone to hypothermia, more prone to skin and soft tissue infection. And so you have to just be very aware of how quickly an older person can develop pressure ulcers in this situation as well.
And I think you've got all of that as a relatively normal process going on affecting all of those sections of A to E. And then comorbidities may have an adverse effect on top of that. But actually, it's more likely that other factors associated with age have a greater effect than just the presence of comorbidity. So, for example, frailty. And maybe location of injury. There was a single centre study from 2015 which looked at mortality based on the location of injury, i.e. was the injury occurred indoors or outdoors, and actually found that mortality was significantly higher in indoor fallers. And I guess we can postulate why that might be. And other studies have also shown that there are different characteristics between those people that fall indoors and those that fall outside, and those that falling indoors are much more frailer and have a higher degree of comorbidities. But what's interesting is that both of those studies failed to show that increasing severity scores significantly impacted on outcome, which fits back with what we were saying about having a high degree of suspicion and not sort of just going on a single numerical score, and that all older people with trauma really need a team-based approach to bolt around their care to make sure that they're getting a truly holistic assessment, and not forgetting, you know, that ultimately often the presentation is a fall. And yes, we have to manage the injuries, but we also have to think about why that fall happened and why the fracture happened, and go back to some of the basic principles of investigating and managing falls and bone health.
We've sort of suggested that outcomes in some older patients may not be as good compared to their younger trauma patients. So what can we do about it to improve these outcomes? And I think it's an area that's growing at the moment in trauma. Everyone's quite interested in what we can do to improve things for our silver trauma patients. And we've seen from the example of the management of neck femur fractures that involvement of geriatricians and a coordinated systematic approach to the management of these patients can significantly improve sort of outcomes, including mortality. So we do have some examples of how a coordinated approach can improve outcomes for older people. So there was a recent paper looking at the management of complex open trauma in the lower limb. And what that showed was that actually aggressive management early to surgery times could have a significant impact on mortality, and that for the patients that did die at longer term follow-up, it was unrelated to their initial injury. And actually, patients had positive reported outcomes as well.
And another large systematic literature review and a meta-analysis of looking at older people who, with traumatic injuries are at higher risk of mortality, as we said, but also just sort of ramming home the point, really, that those people with abnormal physiology at presentation, so with a low systolic blood pressure, were significantly at higher risk of mortality. And that kind of fits with what we've been saying about that physiology, that people may hide their relative degree of unwellness, if you like, but when it presents itself, you know, people really are very sick.
Just to talk a little bit about injury prevention, during the past few decades, research has shown that many injuries can be prevented, or perhaps their severity can be reduced through the implementation of some simple measures, with a view, of course, to improving patient outcomes and using some innovative solutions in order to achieve that as well. Some of these solutions have engaged different sectors of society, and they've resulted in cost-effective interventions, always important, that can prevent injuries at work, at home and on the street. And the examples that people see in everyday life would be the use of motorcycle helmets and restraining systems, meaning sort of seat belts, child restraints in cars, and the installation of fencing around hazards such as wells or deep pools of water. So a lot of common sense things. Many of these strategies have been highly cost effective.
I thought what we would do is just have a little quiz. So what we've got is I've got five interventions that I think probably are relevant at this point. And I think we should just play Guess the Year. Okay. So the first one, I guess, is let's go with, you talked about work, let's go with the Health and Safety Act. You know, we talk about health and safety a lot. How old is that? How long have we been talking about health safety in the UK?
Feels like people have been complaining about it forever.
They have, don't they? But actually, talk about it all the time. How long actually has it been in the law? Have a guess.
Right. I'm going to say 1982.
Yeah, it's a bit older than that. It's 1974. Yeah. Okay, Catherine, one for you.
Okay.
Motorcycle helmets. Everyone wears motorcycle helmets, don't they? They've always done it, haven't they?
Well, yeah, everyone should wear motorcycle helmets. Yeah. Oh, gosh. I imagine in the sort of the 60s and 70s, people weren't that keen. They used to like to have the, mm-hmm. the air in their hair. I'm going to go 1979.
Ah, yeah, okay. I can see what. Yeah, no, a bit earlier, 1973. Okay, then we'll rattle through the next ones. So, seatbelts in cars.
Oh, my granddad didn't have seatbelts in his car when I was born, so I'm showing my age here now, but I'm going to go for 1987.
1983.
Oh, he was one of my earliest
memories.
To the party.
Yeah, one of my earliest memories is my grandmother getting told off for sitting in the passenger seat of the car without a seatbelt on. Policeman knocked on the window, told her off. Yeah. Seatbelts in buses.
Not the London buses.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a bus I've ever sat on that actually had a seatbelt. So that's
or coaches, maybe. Maybe coaches.
So coaches, yeah. That's got to be more recent. That's got to be 1997, 1998, something like that.
Yeah, so it's quite close, very close to 2001. I think it's closest yet. And then the last one is we talk about adult safeguarding and measures to try and make sure and ensure that older adults are safe. When did that become a thing?
I'm sure many of us feel like it's been around for a very long time. 1992.
Yeah, so I think the bit I'm going to get plumb with is the fact that it's in the Care Act, which is 2014. I'm going to go with it, yeah.
Hopefully I won't be struck off the training.
No, I think you'll be all right. I think you'll be all right. But I think it's interesting. So if we think back to, you know, the 1960s, none of those things were in place. And so in the last, you know, 50 years, there's been a huge change in legislation, which has led to a dramatic decrease in trauma and, you know, head injuries and things. Where are we going to be in 50 years' time? You know, and what sort of interventions is it our generation that are going to put in place or your generation are going to put in place to prevent some injuries in the future? You know, it's almost impossible to predict where we're going to be, you know.
That's the big challenge, isn't it? Because we're talking about preventing falls and then balancing that against people's
independence.
And, yeah. A massive challenge.
Yeah, yeah. So we've covered quite a bit in that session. So if you've got anything you want to let us know about, anything on that topic, there will be an MDT Club chat run by Dan Thomas over the next couple of weeks. So use the hashtag MDT Club to access that. Or you can send us a tweet and our Twitter handle is at MDT_podcast, or you can send us a message on Facebook, which is facebook.com/MDT podcast, or via the website, which is www.thehearingaidpodcast.org.uk. And on the website, there are, what have we got on there? There are show notes, which have all got the references and everything. There is a CPD log for you to write your reflections, that will get, you'll get a copy sent to you, and we get to keep a copy so we can have a use your suggestions and your reflections to tailor these episodes to be more useful for you. There are curriculum mapping at the end of the show notes, so you can link your reflections into your curriculum. There are infographics there. There's information about the faculty. All sorts of stuff. Go have a look. And there's the other 60-odd episodes, all there, free, forever. So, yeah, please head on down.
The MDT Podcast.
And now it's time for our MD teaser. This is our catchily titled MDT Isom guessing game. And Joe has sent us in an MD teaser for today. So what we'll do is, rather, normally I'd jump in and try and guess. So what we'll do is we'll all listen in the studio and we'll play you it at home, and then we will see if we can work out what Joe's talking about.
Hi, so I am sending in my MD teaser this time. I hope you like it. So this is a group of people who are together in a room, and some of them have just arrived and some of them are just leaving. And above them there's a body part which is kind of floating. The body part is one of two that most people have, and this body part is sometimes covered purposefully for short periods while you're at work, but usually not. So most of the time it's not, and not in this context.
Covered body part. I kind of think eyes, but then I also don't think Cho would send in something with some dangling eyes. I don't know, that sounds a bit freaky to me.
What would you cover them with? Not everyone wears glasses.
Yeah, but shed occasionally though. So I thought maybe, you know.
Theatre goggles.
Yeah.
Or maybe a theatre hat. You keep your hair covered sometimes at work, sometimes not. But I don't know why it would be.
No, yeah. Not going anywhere. And then what are the people doing?
So the people are, some are coming, some are arriving, some are leaving.
Yes.
They're in a room, they're not outside.
And they're under, aren't they?
Yeah.
Or the thing is over. I know what it is.
It's good job someone does.
It's gloves, isn't it? Yeah. It's gloves, isn't it? So it's hands. And it's, they're putting,
cover, hands. Sometimes gloves. Sometimes gloved.
Yes, hands okay. Over. Handover.
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 And the answer is handover.
Very good. Thank you very much. So there'll be an MD teaser for you if you head on down to Twitter. Pinned to our Twitter profile will be an image as an MD teaser for you. And then the final thing this week is we've got the gallery. So I've brought something this week. I've bought a pullout from a magazine called Flow. And we've talked about Flow previously. Not the magazine, but we've talked about the concept of Flow previously. And so if that means something to you, that's great. If it doesn't mean for you, go back and have a listen to our episode on well-being and what flow is and everything. And there's this nice magazine, anyway, that kind of goes along with it. And it's an article about a Czech photographer called Jan Langer. He took photos of centenarians and put them alongside photos of them when they were younger. But when he's taken the photos of them older, he's put them in exactly the same pose as when they were younger. So you've got this sort of young man looking sort of stern, looking at the camera, and then you've got him when he's over 100 in the same sort of pose. And I just thought it's really nice just seeing the progression of people, and it's quite clear that they're the same people. You know, their eyes and everything look the same, but they've got the effects of a life well lived alongside that. So I'll put a link to that in the on the website.
And that's everything for this week, and the MDT will reconvene in 2 weeks' time.
Dr. Wilkinson has previously received funding from Astellas and UCB Pharmaceuticals for delivering educational activities. The MDT Podcast is a Hearing Aid Podcast's Big Things Media production. Additional music by Kevin MacLeod. This podcast has been made possible from a technology-enhanced learning grant from Health Education England, spreading education throughout Kent, Surrey and Sussex. For more information, visit thehearingaidpodcasts.org.uk.